I'm Afshin Ratansi, and welcome back to Going Underground, broadcasting all around the world from the UAE for the final show of this season, which is all about what makes the world go around: money. Today, on the so-called International Day for Democracy, brought to you by NATO governments who sanction, coup, and invade those who don't vote for their chosen candidates, might be a good day to question whether NATO nation central banks have any idea about money. Clearly, those who make tons of money from the genocide in Gaza and the proxy war on Russia through Ukraine know about money. They know so much about it, arguably, that the sight of dead children means nothing to them compared to the money they receive for it. But did they, or the economists in the ivory towers of academia over generations, or the politicians or central bankers, understand how money retains value? It's an especially pertinent question now. Trump is revolutionizing how money is treated, seeking not only dollar devaluation, but to transform interest rate and tariff policy in the USA. One scholar, who together with Matt Sikirke is claiming that what one learns in economics classes about the creation of money is wrong, is Professor Steve Hanke of Johns Hopkins University. He's advised the governments of Argentina, Bulgaria, Estonia, Ecuador, Montenegro, Venezuela, Yugoslavia, and the UAE. His new book, Making Money Work: How to Rewrite the Rules of Our Financial System, is a devastating analysis of how our basic ignorance is condemning capitalist economies to invest in the wrong things, perhaps leading them to catastrophe. He joins me again from Baltimore in Maryland. Thank you so much, Professor Hanke, for coming back on the show. I better start, for the non-economists amongst us, about how fundamental to your new book and to all our lives is it that money is created by banks, and that, say, as you say, basic economics courses all over the world are wrong when they claim banks lend people money from pre-existing funds.
Afshin, great to be with you, and thank you for having me again. You put your finger on the key point, and that is, banks should be front and center in the financial system. And particularly since the great financial crisis in 2008, banks have been kind of regulated to the sideline, shall we say. Now, why should they be at the center? Because, as you put it, they don't intermediate savings that people save and deposit in banks and then just transmit those into the economy. They create credit out of thin air. They used to call it pen money in the old days. With a pen, you would write out a credit to a good loan, and that would be it. And that's exactly what they do now. So who does intermediate savings? Well, that's investment banks do that. But commercial deposit-taking banks create money out of thin air. Now, why is this so important? This is important because it economizes, if you will, on savings that people make. And remember, from the last book that we talked about on the program, Capital Interest and Waiting, that book made the point that, of course, to save, you have to not consume and wait, and you get paid an interest for it. Well, in this case, savings are economized because you basically get more bang for your buck if you can create credit out of savings without out of thin air, without any savings.
I don't know why more people, I sometimes interview economists on this show who don't kind of steer clear when I mention the town in Switzerland called Basel, which seems a bit strange, because what you're saying there is that basically I go to a bank, I borrow $100, that bank then creates that $100 and multiplies it by a number agreed in a Swiss town. Is that right?
Not exactly. The Swiss town Basel comes into the thing because capital is required to be reserved against the assets that banks have and the credit that they create. But and that regulation does come from Basel, Switzerland. So in a way, that constrains the total amount of credit that banks can create out of thin air. So let me make just three points very quickly. And one of the points you'll see, you've already made it. What does this book do, Making Money Work? we're trying to put the quantity theory of money back in the picture again for central banks, because central banks actually ignore the quantity theory of money. And that means they ignore the money supply and the growth rate in the money supply. They pay attention to interest rates, the Fed funds rate, but they never talk about the money supply. So that is the first point. The second point is putting commercial banks back at the center of the financial system, because they do create credit and they create it out of thin air. And the third point is we want, or we're advocating, monetary policy that's neutral, that doesn't discriminate against one group of people or one sector of the economy or another. And let me give you the reason for the neutrality thing. It's pretty easy to understand. And that is, if you look at January 2020, that was a month before the COVID pandemic hit in February of 2020. And billionaires in the United States had wealth that was equal to 14.1% of gross national product in the United States. Today, that percentage of billionaires' wealth as a percent of GDP has risen to 21.7%. So why? Because monetary policy wasn't neutral. It favored the rich. We had an explosion in the money supply. Money supply started exploding in 2020 and 2021, what happened? Asset prices exploded. Land prices went up. Real estate went up. The stock market went up. And who owns the assets? Well, the rich people own the assets. Poor people don't own any assets. They probably have, most of them have negative balance sheets. Their net asset position is negative. So that's the neutrality aspect. And the idea, coming back to the first point of putting the quantity theory of money in the picture, if you want to hit an inflation target of, let's say, 2% in the United States, and you're paying attention to the quantity theory of money and the money that you're supplying, the monetary growth rate should be about 6% per year. And by the way, that's exactly what it was in the whole period 2010 to 2019. We had the average growth rate in the money supply over that decade was 5.8%, and the inflation rate, consumer price index, was 1.8% in the United States. So okay, that's the way it worked.
To be clear, though, I mean, you were an advisor to Ronald Reagan. What's interesting here, if anyone watching is going, oh, this is just the same old money supply Thatcherism, Reagan Thatcherism. What's important here is that in the book you explain that you are not looking at the traditional money supply indicators of MOM2. Explain how your money supply indicator is very different to the one used perhaps by yourself with Ronald Reagan back in the 1980s.
Okay. Well, that's a key question, Afshin. And if you're going to pay attention to the money supply and the quantity theory of money, you've got to measure the money stock correctly. And the best way to do that now, that there are a lot of components that go into the money supply, depending on the measure, M0, M1, M2, M3, and so forth. And what we do traditionally, or what central banks do traditionally, they just sum those components up until they get, you know, 100% of whatever the money supply measure happens to be. And for example, M2 is the broadest measure that's reported in the United States. And that's a sum of several things, several components in there. Most of the components, by the way, a little of it is currency that's produced by the Fed, but the main part are liquid deposits at commercial banks. You add all those things up. Now, there's another way to measure, a more accurate way, and a more scientific way, and that's what's called divisia. A divisia aggregation weights all
named
the components.
Named after a French economist, divisia.
Actually a French engineer. Divisia was actually a French engineer, but but practicing applied economics at the highest level. So, and a graduate of the great Pons and Chausset, the great engineering school in France, one, by the way, that I'm associated with. But in any case, be that as it may, the Divisia Index weights the components, and the weights that you put on the components are determined by the moneyness, how close to transactional money and cash the various components happen to be. And obviously, one component that gets a 100% weight is cash. But then, if we go out all the way to M4, a very broad measure and a good measure for money, Divisia M4, the last thing are T-bills, treasury securities. That actually counts at the money supply, but it counts with a lower weight than cash, because to get cash, you have to take your treasury bills and exchange them for cash. But if the interest rate happens to be very high on those treasury bills, you're not too keen about transferring the treasury bills and obtaining cash that you can use in a transaction. Because in a transaction in the store, you don't take treasury bills into the store. You take cash in. Or you write a check on your checking account and use that, but you don't use a treasury bill. But treasury bills can be transferred into deposit money or bills, notes, and coins very easily. But if the interest rate's very high, you don't want to do this. And that means what? The weight that you put on the treasury account will be much lower than cash itself. And as the interest rate goes up, 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 the weight on the treasury bills will be less, less, less.
And can we get to why this is so disturbing, the data in your book, because you're using these Divisia money supply indicators? You know, I have an old edition here from the Japanese FT. European defense sector rally falters on Ukraine peace talks. People might ask, what's the relevance of that? What your Divisia data shows is how the economies of these G7 countries are skewing themselves to focus strategically on often the wrong things to make these economies ever develop. Is that one of the horrible conclusions?
You read the Japanese picture. Let's talk about the measure of the money supply and the quantity theory of money. And look at Japan from 1996 until 2019, and the interest rate was 0.125%. And all the economists were only looking at the interest rate. They were ignoring the money supply. And they said, oh, monetary policy is very easy in Japan, too easy, too loose. In fact, if they would have looked at the money supply, M2, it was only growing at 2.8% per year. It, in fact, was very tight. It wasn't easy. It was tight. And
okay,
we know that.
Hang on, Professor. Professor, I'll stop you there. More from the Johns Hopkins Applied Economics Professor Steve Hanke, and co-author of Making Money Work, after this break. Welcome back to Going Underground. I'm still here with the Johns Hopkins Applied Economics Professor and co-author of Making Money Work, Professor Steve Hanke. Professor, yeah, I rudely interrupted you when you were in the middle of explaining how no one understood the Japanese economic miracle before the Japanese crash.
Well, absolutely. Most economists were looking at the interest rate. It was de minimis. It was almost zero. And they said the monetary policy was too easy, too loose. In fact, the money supply was only growing at 2.8% per year. It was very tight. And that's why in the period 1996 to 2019, you had an average inflation rate of 0.2%, almost nothing. There was no inflation. And that's because the money supply was hardly growing. And the monetary policy was extremely tight. But the Bank of Japan had it all wrong. They said it was too easy. And most of the economists said it was too easy because the interest rates were almost zero. The point being here, monetary policy is not about interest rates. It's about the money supply. What's going on with the money supply? And as you got into with me, you've got to measure the money supply properly if that's the key to the economy. And the best way to do that is with these Devisia measures. And by the way, in the United States, you can get those at the Center for Financial Stability in New York. And of course, the guru on this now is William A. Barnett, a professor of economics at the University of Kansas. So he's the guy now. He's the guy really in charge of the proper measurement. And by the way, you can get way off on this. Let's look at Paul Volcker. You mentioned the Reagan years when I was Reagan's advisor, and Paul Volcker, of course, was the chairman of the Federal Reserve. Now, Reagan told Volcker, get after this inflation and kill it. And he was a monetarist. He was looking at the money supply. But he actually was looking at these simple sum numbers, not Devisia numbers. And he thought he was modestly tightening. But in fact, if you looked at the Devisia numbers, he was in a massive tightening. There was a huge difference between the simple sum measures and the Devisia measures. And the reason for that was inflation was high and interest rates were high. If interest rates are low and inflation is low, there's not that much difference between a simple sum measure and a Devisia measure. But as the interest rates go up, you tend to get a gap between those two measures, meaning that at higher interest rates and higher inflation rates, the central banks are, if they were looking at money, if they were looking at it, which are not looking at it, they'd be looking at the wrong monetary measure.
I'm not sure what measures they're looking at the moment. I know that maybe Trump's advisors are looking at the book. Maybe they're going to speak to Barnett from Kansas because it's not so far. But I suppose I have to also ask you that reading the Devisia data, what do you think Karl Marx would have thought? Would he not think that your conclusions based on the Barnett Devisia money supply data shows your desperate attempt to salvage something of capitalism out of it, when in fact, it's not just a technical indicator. The Devisia data also shows that it is, money is a commodification of labor power, and it's in the interests of the powerful to make the mistake and use the Reagan wrong numbers to be able to cloud the issue and hide the fact that they are keeping the power. Once your Devisia data comes out and is being used by more and more people, people will realize how the powerful have used economic indices to protect the wealth of the top 0.01%.
Well, what you said, number one, Marx would be looking at the money supply because all the classical economists.
Well, he'd love your tables much more than the ones that were erroneously used by Paul Volcker, clearly.
So the point that you're making, though, about the wealth distribution is the third point of our book, and that is neutrality. You want to have a monetary policy that's as neutral as you possibly can make it, not favoring one group or another group. That's the key. And as I went over those statistics earlier, who made out when we had this huge explosion in the money supply during the pandemic and the inflation that followed and the asset price boom that followed? Well, rich people did. The Federal Reserve, by not following a neutral monetary policy, actually aggravated the income distribution and distorted it more than any other institution in the United States government.
Yeah, but do you think that it shows, that data shows that actually profit-seeking is leading to this disproportionate, inefficient sectoral overproduction? I mean, you'd say it's due to the power relations and maybe some type of regulation could be involved. But isn't it something inherent here?
I don't think so. And I think what you end up with making money work and what we're prescribing is, number one, you control the growth in the money supply measured properly by Divisia. That's part of the picture, one. Two, the monetary policy should also include those bank regulations like Basel you mentioned, the capital asset ratios, things like that, that affect commercial banks because they produce most of the money and the bank regulations affect them. And the bank regulations, for example, right now, they're talking about taking off a supplementary liquidity ratio, a reserve ratio that was put on banks after the great financial crisis started in 2008. That's a good idea because it's excessive and it's basically the wrong thing to do. They're requiring banks to reserve against very safe assets like treasury bonds, the same way they reserve against risky assets and loans that they're making on more risky projects. So it's a bad regulation, and it's constraining the capacity of banks to actually create money out of thin air and loan it to who? Loan it to good bankable projects. And you know you've got a good bankable project if the credit evaluation is done by the bank, the collateral is supplied by the loan recipient to the bank, and if things go bad, of course, the bank takes the collateral, but the bank anticipates with a good bankable project that the project will generate a surplus, and that surplus will be able to be used to pay interest and amortize the debt, and that's it.
Not just real estate and fintech unicorns that are now the vogue. I want to get on to why you think maybe, I don't know, it's a question whether you think that if they say the genocide Joe Biden administration had understood your data, they'd have also better understood why tariffs, sanctions on Russia over the proxy war on Russia through Ukraine would never work, because they can extrapolate some of the Divisia data of money supply, if they do it on an international scale, to understand why it was doomed to failure.
Well, I think
maybe your next book this would have to be.
We're talking about a couple of separate things here. One it is related to money, and that's the fact that the U.S. has weaponized the U.S. dollar with these sanctions. A lot of these financial sanctions end up weaponizing the U.S. dollar, and that is a negative. That is a negative for the dollar. It makes the dollar more vulnerable, and it makes it subject to potential challengers to come into the picture. Right now, those challengers haven't amounted to peanuts, by the way. But the reality is that a lot of people now are talking about the dollar and whether the dollar will stay, the king will stay on the throne as it's done since World War I, or whether there'll be a challenger that comes in and replaces it or provides an attractive substitute. Now, that's not the case. The dollar's still king, no matter what they say. And by the way, it's very hard to knock a king off the throne, because if you go back, Ashrin, 2,500 years, we've only had 14 kings. So the kings tend to stay on the throne for a long time. They get knocked off when monetary policy becomes faulty. And that does lead back to the book, Making Money Work. We're trying to make monetary policy and money more coherent, more efficient, running more smoothly. And to the extent that any central bank follows that course, they're gonna end up with a currency that is more stable and more attractive. Now, just look at the Swiss, by the way. The Swiss have pay attention to all these components that we're talking about. They pay attention to neutrality of money, they pay attention to the quantity theory of money, and they pay attention to bank regulations. And what's happened? Since World War I, the only currency actually in the world that's appreciated in real inflation-adjusted terms is the Swiss franc. The Swissie, in a way, is a little king. It's not an international thing like the United States dollar, because Switzerland's a fairly small country.
Yeah, you know, I was just about to get on to, I mean, Switzerland, not so neutral right now. It's imposing sanctions on Russia along with the NATO people. We're running out of time, alas. Let's just get to quality of life as opposed to necessarily the strength of the currency. Just finally, do you think it's the sectoral imbalances that come out of this lack of understanding of money supply that are responsible for, say, the life expectancy in Mississippi is 71, Virginia 72, in Cuba it's 78. In Venezuela, where you advised, I understand, in the 90s, 76 and a half. In Iran, 81. Let alone the fact that China may understand their money supply of the renminbi, maybe, I don't know, using this form of Divisia Robonet data, as opposed to the data that is used by the G7. Do you think that's what's behind the successes of some of these countries? Because they're not relying on useless money supply indicators and power dynamics divorced from economic theory?
Yeah, I would say the combination of those three elements that I mentioned that our book focuses on, the successful ones pay attention to the quantity theory of money and control the quantity theory of money so that they can hit their desired inflation targets. Point number one. Point number two, they realize that bank regulations affect the ability of banks